how you should understand what we're about to get. Last year, then Google CEO Eric Schmidt was at Davos in Switzerland talking about this in the keynote address, and he said that the stuff he was working on at Google and that his other computer firms are working on were in the process of pretty much going to eliminate most white-collar employment, not just the factory jobs, but white-collar employment. It was so sophisticated. And Schmidt said that for the next 2 to 3 decades, the single most dominant political issue in the world was going to be automation and the huge unemployment that was coming.
You're listening to Robert McChesney, Capitalism in the Age of Digital Technology. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Now, traditionally, the way economists have dealt with this threat of automation, which they've never really, they said, let's see it first before we get worried about it. They said, well, the way you prevent all these companies from buying robots, no matter how inexpensive they get, is you have lower wages. And if workers are willing to work for less, then the companies won't have incentive to get new technology and robots. Well, this explosion, this Cambrian explosion, is so profound. The power of this technology is so profound for what you have to pay for it, that even the prospect of lower wages can't compete with it. And what better example of this than China? There's a company in China many of you probably have heard called Foxconn. They probably made most of the unit gadgets in this room. They've got 1.2 million workers. It's one of the biggest company, the biggest manufacturing company in the world. I think it's $135 billion in annual revenue. They've got labor practices right out of a Charles Dickens novel. I mean, this is the place you might remember 5 or 6 years ago. They had came out that a bunch of their workers commit suicide. Their jobs were so horrible. They were killing themselves rather than go to work. So they had to hire a PR firm after that. And Foxconn. So this is a company that made its name by exploiting labor. Took all those Midwestern factory jobs and said, okay, we'll get labor for you. We'll handle this. Foxconn is basically one of the largest purchasers of robots in the world. They've already got a factory themselves. It's completely robot, automated, where they never turn the lights on. They never have to turn the lights on. That's what they said. And the CEO of Foxconn said, within a decade or two, we'll be completely automated too. It's just, we have to be able to do that to compete with what's coming. We can't compete with heavily exploited, inexpensive labor. Even though there's still hundreds of millions of Chinese people in the countryside ready to come to the cities to work. They're not even in the workforce yet. That's what Foxconn's planning. So, pretty interesting developments here. Now, this is not a new thing. It's not like automation is just happening right now. You've never heard the term before. In fact, in doing the research for my book, I recalled that when I was very young, in the 1960s, there was a lot of talk about automation. And people even older than I am will remember it well. In the early first half of the 1960s, it was a major news story in the United States. There were presidential commissions on it. There were hearings in Congress. UNESCO did studies of it. President Kennedy and President Johnson both gave speeches on the subject. Because as soon as computers came along in the 1940s, instantly people got it that eventually they would be able to do the work humans did. It was almost instant. Norbert Wiener, the great cybernetics pioneer who really led the way in digital communication at MIT, understood instantly. He said, when you have machines competing with labor, the only way labor will ever be to survive is to be slave labor. That's what his quote was. This is the guy who started cybernetics at MIT. And they understood that it made perfect sense for business to want to get rid of labor, lower costs and produce more. It's rational business behavior. And this could be disastrous for the economy and certainly for the people who were getting eliminated from work. Now, it didn't really happen in the 1960s. We didn't have automation that created massive unemployment. Quite the contrary, by the end of the decade, we had the lowest unemployment rate probably in American history, or at least modern American history, thanks to the Vietnam War. I mean, it was like 3%. I mean, jobs were falling out of trees and hitting in the head. And if we look at that period now, we can see the technology they were so concerned about is laughably primitive. I mean, it's like one of those 1950s science fiction movies. I mean, it's like, how could people actually think this sort of technology was going to be a threat to take away jobs. And it wasn't that much of a threat. But now it is a threat. Now we're at a whole different level by orders of magnitude. That's what is coming. And it's taking place very quickly. Now, there's one other problem, though, with what's happening here. A lot of other problems. One of them is that U.S. capitalism right now, the way our economy works, is not especially well-positioned for this to take place. I mean, no economy is well-positioned to have lose a lot of jobs. But we've already been through a 40-year process in which we've seen a huge growth of people dropping out of the labor markets who can't find work, stagnant wages, unemployment growing, so that now the normal accepted levels of unemployment much higher than they were 40 years ago. I mean, these were big problems already. And now we're going to add this to the mix? This is a very, very fundamental problem. You think inequality has been a problem until now? You ain't seen nothing yet, unless you make significant changes. It also is a real fundamental problem for a capitalist economy. Capitalist economies to work, you need people to buy stuff, and then companies invest in factories or businesses and hire people to produce the stuff people are buying. Well, if there aren't people making incomes, they don't buy stuff, and then firms have no reason to invest because they can't sell anything. That's already a problem in our economy. We've got $2 trillion in liquid capital companies own. They're not investing because they can't do good investments. They can't find a way to make money. They're sitting on that's why interest rates are virtually nothing. They're giving capital away. So we add this into the mix. It's an absolute nightmare. Capitalism, simply to be blunt, doesn't compute in this situation. It's having trouble computing now, but it doesn't compute in this situation. In fact, our current economy could well look like a golden age compared to what may be coming 10 or 20 years down the road. It's sort of a supreme irony here that we have now the technology so that not that many people have to work and we can produce a lot. We have the technology so we can address the vexing environmental problems with probably far less of a cost than we're going to probably have to end up paying. We have the technology so that we could have a much higher standard of living. The output per worker is radically higher than it was six, seven times, depending on the industry, than it was 50 years ago. Yet our standard of living for most people is lower. There's endless calls for cutbacks and stagnation at the same time. This enormous paradox, and it's only understood by understanding the problems built into the way capitalism works. This is a radical argument, and certainly it's an argument Marx made. It was the center of his critique of capitalism. But not just Marx. If you look at the great economists of the 19th and 20th century, John Stuart Mill, Thorsten Veblen, most importantly, John Maynard Keynes, they all said the same thing. They said, look, capitalism is going to develop the technological capacity, but at a certain point in time, it won't work with the way capitalism set up to make profits. It's going to outdo itself, and then we're going to have to get past it. And these were people who were champions of capitalism in their time, at least a couple of them, Mill and Keynes. Keynes, in his most famous essay on this subject, he wrote an essay, The Depths of the Great Depression, in 1930, an essay to his grandchildren, he called it. And he said, in 100 years from now, there probably won't be much need for any labor. We'll be able to produce everything that society will need. And this is before computers. This guy nailed it 100 years from now. We'll solve what he said, the economic problem. The economic problem which has obsessed all species, including humanity, for their entire history, getting enough to survive, solving the material requirements of life. He said, we will solve that for the first time ever. And he said, it's going to put humanity in a very different space, a very interesting space. And it's probably going to create more than a little angst as people try to figure out what to do. But it will ultimately lead to a much better place. That was his argument. It's a brilliant essay. It's online. It's only like 7 pages. It's well worth reading. But my point simply is that our greatest economic thinkers understood this was a tension built within capitalism, that it was just a matter of time till it would basically hit its expiration date. And I would argue that this looks to be the time that capitalism as we know it has hit its expiration date. Now, the immediate place these tensions are going to play out, I think it's fairly obvious, is in the political realm. It's going to be a hot political issue. Maybe not in terms of automation, maybe not in terms of technology, but in terms of the economic effects of stagnation, declining incomes, and inequality, if they grow even greater than they are now, which is almost certain, barring some changes. And here we have another problem. You know, capitalism has been stagnating for a while. It's had very slow growth relative to a generation or two ago. But political democracy has hardly been experiencing a golden age in the United States. Quite the contrary. There are 3 studies that came out in the last 5 years by some of our leading political scientists at Princeton and University of Virginia, University of California at Stanford, independent studies, and they all reach the exact same conclusion, pretty much, that the people of this country have no effect over policies of the government. If you want to know how decisions are made, you just have to see what the wealthiest individuals who are affected want, and they get what they want. Even when the vast majority of people want something and wealthy people don't want it, the vast majority of people never win, ever. That's what the research shows. You know, it's this sort of research that led former President Jimmy Carter 2 years ago in a private meeting with some visitors from Germany when they asked him to lay of the land of the United States, say the United States is no longer a democracy. It's no longer a democracy. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Now, I think part of the reason it's no longer a democracy is most people don't participate. We have the lowest voter participation rate in the world by a wide margin compared to our peer countries. But I think that's going to change. I think there's going to be a lot more interest in politics. I think that's the moment we're getting into, because people, it's not an optional thing. It's not like, gee, I think I might get interested in it because I'd rather do that than go hunt for butterflies. It's a matter of survival. It's a matter of literally the survival. You're going to have to get, people are going to be involved. It's starting now. It's going to increase. It's going to be a very important period of our lives, and it's really going to be definitional for much of this century and beyond. Now, there are two historical periods that I write about and research in this book that are relevant to what we're about to go through. What we're in now with stagnation or unemployment and what we're looking forward to in the next few years. The first one is the 1930s. Because then, as you may know, there was widespread mass unemployment in the world, similar to what we're talking about now, across the industrial world. And there we saw something new that emerged, fascism. This was an extraordinary idea, fascism. Mass movements to end democracy. A mass movement to get rid of democracy. It was really a quite extraordinary phenomenon. It became very successful. And what fascism was able to do, it went into societies that had massive unemployment, like Germany, at 2015, 20, 25% unemployment. And it said that where all the existing mainstream parties have been unable to solve anything with their conventional policies. And it said, the problem is democracy. These guys don't have their act together. Trust us, we can take care of everything. And what they did and how they got business support is that they used the government to stimulate the economy, but almost all the money went to militarism. And so it didn't threaten business in any way. And it led to war worldwide very quickly as a result. Fascist movements, clearly probably the most shameful developments in human history, certainly modern human history. They play in every case on racism, bigotry, chauvinism of one kind or another. That's their stock in trade, because they can't talk about what actually matters in people's lives, because that's not what they're about. And what's interesting about this is we're going to see these again. We're seeing them already in countries now, like Greece, that have significant permanent unemployment and the mainstream has collapsed. We're seeing the return of fascist movements, even in countries like Greece, where fascism was completely repudiated politically after the dictatorship of the late 60s and even in the 1940s. So it's coming back. It's growing. And if what I'm talking about continues, we should expect to see a lot more of it. People are desperate for solutions, and it offers a way out of the problem. But what we learn from that is not to fear fascism. What we learn is that there were a lot of people in the United States and worldwide who studied the emergence of fascism around the world, Germany, Italy, Japan, Hungary, and they said, "What can we? Why did it rise, and what can we do to make sure it never happens again? What does a democratic society do to prevent fascism?" And this was a very important issue to, of all people, President Franklin Roosevelt of the United States, who was, you know, Supreme Allied Commander, or at least the head of the war effort in the United States when we entered the war. And Roosevelt gave two very famous speeches on this and talked about it otherwise, but in the State of the Union addresses he gave. And he argued that the way to prevent fascism from ever returning, including in the United States, and he was very pointed about this, was that it was imperative that business monopolies be eliminated, that you could not have concentrated economic power, that you'd end militarism, that the war and militarism was a spawning ground of fascist mentality. You have to invigorate democratic institutions like education, and you have to guarantee a minimal standard of living for every person. That meant everyone should have guaranteed health care, guaranteed employment, right to belong to a labor union. FDR went so far in 1944 to say this should be in the Constitution. That's how important this is. He called it the Second Bill of Rights. He said this should be the next slab in the Constitution, guaranteeing these rights to all Americans. He said if we do this, we'll never have fascism. This will prevent fascism. Fascism only occurs in countries where the system is discredited, where it's corrupt, it's ineffectual. Those are words I think would be wise for us to pay very careful attention to today. I think there's a lot of wisdom there. The second place where we need to look, if we want to understand how to deal with our problem, is the 1960s. The 1960s was a period, of course, of the first automation hysteria, where people took it seriously as an issue. It was the first time, to my knowledge, in human history, and unfortunately almost the only time, in which people actually thought seriously about what it would mean to live in a post-scarcity world where the economic problem is solved. What it would mean when we could give everyone the basic requirements of a decent life, that could accommodate them. What could human life be like then? What could we possibly achieve? And many of you have probably heard of LBJ's Great Society, President Johnson, which he launched with great fanfare in Ann Arbor in 1965. Well, I read the speech. It's worth reading. He's basically talking about a world in which the great wealth that the society is generating and the technology is generating can provide for everyone and take care of all our needs, and that we need to think morally and creatively about what's the point of life. It's really a rather existential and poignant message. And the great optimism in the speech that we can build the greatest cities and people can develop their faculties and their talents, everyone. And if you go back and look at the 60s, there were a lot of people who were raising issues like that. The New Left talked about that. The Paris uprising, the French uprising in May 1968, their slogans, all power to the imagination, be realistic, demand the impossible, invoking the idea that we could do something that transcends what's ever been done before and think that way. The whole hippie movement, which has been trivialized, ridiculed, marginalized or co-opted by Madison Avenue in Hollywood into a bunch of irrelevant goofballs or cool people who got laid a lot. However you want to slice the hippie movement, it actually had a lot of interesting stuff going there. It was a profound critique of a post-scarcity society. And it deserves to be taken seriously for that reason. Because that's the first time any society's actually come to terms with, what could we do? What would a society look like if we could actually have the ability, without using much human labor, to provide a quality life for most people. And I think they came up with some interesting ideas. Now, the problem, of course, was that by the end of the 1960s and early 1970s, that sort of approach to human life was very threatening to business. And in the 1970s, we saw an extraordinary counter-revolution in America, led by the business community, to sort of change our politics, to make them very pro-business, to make the needs of business be the preeminent needs in determining what's done politically in society, giving us the era we still live in to this day, the world we inhabit today. And we sort of purged the memory of the 1960s. We purged the memory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and what he was, and the whole anti-fascist movements and what they stood for. Well, we've got to resurrect those histories because they're the relevant histories if we want a way out of where we are now in a creative way, in a positive way, in a humane way. That's the history we need to incorporate. Now, to conclude the talk, and it's a big picture talk, right? We're talking about the future of our species and all that sort of stuff. Where better to go than Mr. Big Picture himself, Stephen Hawking, Big Bang guy. And I don't know if any of you saw this, but just a few weeks ago, Stephen Hawking did an Ask Me Anything Reddit interview. Did some of you see that? And someone asked him specifically about this issue. And he apparently has been following it pretty closely. Actually, most scientists are following this pretty closely. And his comment was basically about technology. He said, the outcome of how this is going to happen will depend entirely on how things are distributed. Everyone can enjoy a life of luxurious leisure if the machine-produced wealth is shared. Or most people can end up miserably poor if the machine owners successfully lobby against wealth redistribution. So far, the trend seems to be toward the second option, with technology driving ever-increasing inequality. Now, I thought I was the Prince of Darkness. That's what I'm usually called. I give my talks. People are usually looking for window ledges to jump off of. And so Hawking is here to challenge me for the title there. But I think Hawking makes the proper point. I mean, that's really the dilemma we face as a people, as a society going forward. Is this economy going to work for us or for them? Are we going to build an economy that fosters the good life for all of us, a democracy, or is it going to be their economy and we're just sort of extras that we don't get in the way? If we do, we get locked up. That's more or less the world we're looking at. Now, despite the fact that seems grim, I'm actually a great optimist. I'm actually very hopeful for where we're going to go in the future of this country. I'm confident democracy will triumph because I think the vast majority of people want it, benefit by it, and are going to be being penalized heavily by the type of society we currently have and the one that's looking at us down the road. But I have no illusions. We've got our work cut out for us. Thank you.
I've got a two-part question, one related to the press and educating voters, and the other one getting voters out to really vote. What do you see happening with media?
A lot of the work I've done on media has been trying to address the journalism crisis, and one of the things I've proposed in everything I write is I think it's a public policy issue. The United States, prior to advertising coming to support journalism in the late 19th and early 20th century, had the richest, most diverse press system in the world from 1790 to 1880. And it wasn't that it was a free market. In fact, it was just the opposite. At the beginning of the country, the first 100 years, we had massive subsidies, postal and printing subsidies that made the distribution of newspapers close to free. So it took the cost way down, so it made it really easy to start a newspaper because the government understood we had to have a press to have self-government. It was a conscious plan to have these massive postal and printing subsidies. Jefferson, Madison, this was central to their vision for the country, and it worked. For the most part, the genius of the subsidies was it went to abolitionist papers and papers that weren't abolished. The censorship was rare. We know about it because it was when the Southern post offices refused to distribute abolitionist papers. Those are the times it didn't work. But that jumped out, and that was one of the main factors that mobilized Northern support for going to war with the South too. That repression of abolitionist papers in the South. So we have a history there of supporting journalism and great journalism. And now that the commercial system is dying and gone, we get to return to that. Journalism is the public good. Is the fourth estate is a branch of the democratic infrastructure that's non-negotiable. We need it. So, I asked for getting people to vote. That was the second half of the question. Well, I don't know if there's a simple answer to that. You know, I think it would help if they had a reason to vote, if they felt like their vote mattered. The problem Democrats face is they don't give people a reason to vote for them. So in these off-year elections, they say, hey, Republicans are horrible, come out and vote for us. Well, that works for some people. That works for probably most people in this room. But for my 20-year-old daughter and her friends, you know, in a presidential year that works. But, you know, they get lost in the shuffle. Because no matter who gets elected, nothing changes. So the scaring youth Republicans works in presidential years. And it might work for this year, but it doesn't work well enough. Offering a positive message, like in Seattle, saying, actually, yeah, we can have $15 an hour minimum wage. We can really change something. We can cut the military budget. We don't have to have, we have so many wars now. No one even, there'd probably be a great contest how many people name all the countries we're fighting now. I mean, it's like right out of Orwell. We could, if we had a positive thing, I think people will vote. I think people will look to politics and hope that politics will respond favorably within our system. That's my goal.
You were just listening to Robert McChesney on Capitalism in the Age of Digital Technology. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded at the University of Wisconsin at Madison in 2015. Robert McChesney was a leading media historian and public intellectual. He was a champion of independent progressive media. He passed away in late March 2025. He was a friend and ally and will be missed. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Maria Lopez Nunez, Gabor Mate, Shama Sawant, Chris Hedges, and Ralph Nader. And we have a series of programs featuring Robert McChesney. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robert McChesney on Capitalism in the Age of Digital Technology, and for the Noam Chomsky classic book, Who Rules the World, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sam Fuqua. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with one of Robert McChesney's favorite songs, Mighty Sparrow, singing Capitalism Gone Mad.
You got to be a millionaire or some kind of petty bourgeoisie anytime you live in here. In this country, you got to be in skullduggery, making you money illicitly to live like somebody. In this country, it's outrageous and insane. Them crazy prices in Port of Spain, and like the merchants going out their brain, and the working man like the only toiling in vain. Where you ever hear a television for 7,000 quarter million falling piece of land? A pair of sneakers, $200, 80, 90,000 for motor cars. At last, here in Trinidad, we see capitalism gone mad. It's sad and getting more bad, because doo-doo, capitalism gone mad.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. The ocean absorbs almost a third of the world's climate warming carbon pollution, so it plays a critical role in limiting global warming. And scientists are researching ways to help the ocean absorb and store even more CO2. Alicia Karspeck is with Seaworthy, a nonprofit research group that's investigating a method called ocean alkalinity enhancement. The approach involves adding certain crushed minerals, like lime or silicate, to the ocean. That increases the water's alkalinity, triggering a chemical process that converts dissolved carbon dioxide into a molecule called bicarbonate. The carbon then stays locked in this form for thousands of years.
It's actually a natural process that happens already on very long geologic timescales, and it's a matter of just accelerating that natural process.
Doing so reduces the amount of dissolved CO2 at the ocean surface,
which then allows the ocean to actually take up more carbon from the atmosphere.
Her group is partnering on research to study the approach and monitor its impact on marine ecosystems and ocean chemistry. There are many questions to answer before it can be deployed on a large scale, but it could one day provide a way to help reduce climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of a community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain. We'll be right back.
You're listening to